Welcome to Red Meat, the conservative news update you need from Odyssey stations across the country. This is the place where we're not afraid to dig in.
Are we going to own Spirit Airlines?
Well, are we? Let's kick things off with questions about another bailout and what it means for everyday Americans. Here's WCCO.
Did you want to own Spirit Airlines? You know, if the U.S. government is going to buy an airline, it seems appropriate that it's Spirit Airlines. Federal officials in the Transportation and Commerce Department considering a deal that would loan Spirit $500 million in exchange for an ownership stake in the airline. This seems strange to me, so we thought we'd reach out to Thrifty Traveler. And Gunnar Olson from Thrifty Traveler joins us right now on the John Schuster Coldwell Banker Hotline. Gunnar, thank you so much for the time. Thanks for being available. We've seen the U.S. intervene in the airline industry before, but that was more broadly, you know, COVID, 9/11, where we've kind of boosted the airline industry. But one specific airline, though, I don't seem to recall this ever happening before. This seems unprecedented to me.
Yeah, you're spot on. This is very unusual, and especially a deal that would not only loan them lots of money as a sort of bailout, but also take an ownership stake in an airline up to 90%. It's something that we really haven't seen. We've seen smaller ownership stakes trade hands, you know, during the bailouts after 9/11 and after the pandemic, but we haven't seen anything of this scale, especially for an airline that is really small in the grand scheme of things in the United States travel industry.
And Gunnar, can you kind of give us the history of why Spirit is in trouble? I know there was a merger proposed between JetBlue and Spirit that the Biden administration opposed and a judge ruled against it. But why is, because, as you know, Spirit is one of these low-budget carriers, and for people who just don't have a lot of money to book, it always seemed like a decent option. Why is Spirit in so much trouble?
Yeah, well, the Biden administration nixed that merger with JetBlue. They basically said it was anti-competitive. They thought that the merging of those two airlines would be bad for airfare. And they were right insofar as the leading driver of airfare is competition. You know, when we just saw this here in Minneapolis, when Spirit bailed out of MSP Airport, the fares on the routes that they were running, the ones to Atlanta and to Detroit from here in MSP, went up overnight. Delta decided, without Spirit putting competitive pressure on them, that they could charge whatever they want. The problem with Spirit Airlines is now, you know, they're in their second bankruptcy in 3 years right now. They're struggling for sure, and that's because the airline industry has really leaned into the premium flyer. You know, Delta and United and American are focused so much on the front of the plane, those people sitting in first class and those extra legroom seats, that they, you know, are spending less time considering the people in the back who want to pay less and want that lowest fare. And I think, you know, unfortunately, the market is just not in the favor of Spirit right now.
Do you think a government-owned Spirit could actually function competitively?
I don't know. I just think that, you know, the government getting into an airline that is right now flying about 1.5% of available seat miles. That's how we measure capacity in the industry. I mean, that's just such
fraction,
a tiny airline.
Yeah.
And you know, the government owning them isn't going to bring them back to profitability. You know, really the only way to get out of bankruptcy like this is to shrink, is to fly fewer and fewer flights, which they've done over the last few years. So I don't know why the U.S. government owning them would make them better. I guess the idea would be that they own them long enough that they could, you know, Spirit could be acquired by another airline or merge with another airline. I guess that's the only way I could see this working out. But, I mean, for now, it seems like there's been quite a bit of blowback after this announcement. We've seen people on both sides of the aisle, Ted Cruz and Elizabeth Warren, both tweeting today. They think it's a bad idea. It's hard to get those two to agree on anything. So right now, I think, you know, maybe the White House is taking a look at where the wind is blowing and trying to make a decision, but we should hear more today.
Yeah, even Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy says it sure sounds like it doesn't seem like a good idea. What if Spirit goes away? Is this just a trend now that we're seeing that these smaller budget carriers just can't make a go of it? Or what's kind of your vision on how the airline industry is impacted by this and what we could see in the coming years?
Yeah, and you know, I want to say unequivocally, losing budget airlines like this is not good for consumers. You may hate to fly Spirit. I think many people who are listening would say I would rather fly anybody other than Spirit, But Spirit's existence is so important for you as a traveler, whether you're a Delta first class traveler or someone who's just looking for the cheapest flight. The existence of Spirit, the health of these ultra low cost carriers, is what puts that competitive pressure on Delta. So say, you know, that Delta flight that you want to fly from Minneapolis to Atlanta, instead of Delta charging you, you know, $450 or more for that flight just to sit in row 32, now when included, you know, Spirit's going to offer that flight for about $55. So Delta's got to make a decision. Do we want the passenger or do we want to, you know, fly empty planes to Atlanta? So, I mean, Spirit's existence, the existence of the low-cost carriers in general, is really important. But, you know, insofar as the grand scheme of things for the airline industry, I think most experts predicted that some consolidation was coming, that some of the airlines were going to have to merge, combine, get bought out. You know, we saw what happened with Sun Country recently, earlier this year, when Allegiant acquired them. We figured that there would be some consolidation, but, you know, for people who are cheering for Spirit's demise, I think that you're going to end up paying more in the end. This is definitely not a good thing for travelers.
Talking to Gunnar Olson from Thrifty Traveler, we appreciate his time. I was going to bring up the Allegiant and Sun Country merger. How is that progressing? And just to remind people here, and I just flew on Sun Country a couple of weeks ago, and I will later this summer. What, if any, changes are we going to see with service at MSP because of that merger?
In the near term, for things you have booked right now, nothing. This is going to take a long time. The mergers like this usually take a while. There are, you know, lots of I's to dot and T's to cross here. But long term, what we see after consolidation like this is not typically more service. Now, Allegiant and Sun Country did come forward and say, you know, this merger is going to lead to more service and better service at MSP. I really hope they're right. History has not been kind to that sort of analysis. Usually it means there's fewer flights. And like we just mentioned, fewer Sun Country flights out of MSP just means more pricing control for Delta, which has me nervous for the long-term future of airfare here, while Delta already has a stranglehold on this market. I mean, it could just get worse and worse. But for now, if you have a Spirit or a Sun Country flight booked in the next, you know, 10 months, that will operate as a Sun Country flight, and you won't see any noticeable changes.
Yeah, I know it's kind of died down a little bit, but there was talk about United and American merging. I mean, obviously those are two huge carriers. Why all the merger talk right now? And I would imagine just for all the reasons you gave, and for all the reasons, it should make flyers nervous that less competition is not a good thing.
Definitely. I think the merger talk is because they see more likely to approve bigger deals like this. Administration was, you know, guarding competitive pressure in the U.S. airline market very closely. They wanted to make sure that fares stayed low and that there were as many competitive airlines as possible to keep those fares low. In the Trump White House, they're maybe seeing an opportunity to, you know, get some consolidation across the finish line and maybe, you know, combine some airlines and have fewer competitors out there. As for the American and United murmurs, I think that was more United maybe dangling a big risky merger that is unlikely to happen, so that if they instead propose something, you know, a little less grand down the line, that the you know, the government would be a little more likely to approve it. So say, you know, say United wants to now merge with JetBlue in a few weeks, all of a sudden it looks very small and very insignificant compared to dangling United and American. So that may have just been a little bit of posturing from United.
I see.
We'll just say that buying Spirit Airlines has been compared to buying, well, insert your own joke here. But let's move on. Here's the Annie Fry Show with the latest on the Southern Poverty Law Center scandal.
Money doesn't lie. The charity that supposedly fought the Klan funded the Klan. The charity that supposedly fought neo-Nazis funded neo-Nazis. The Southern Poverty Law Center ran a methodical, calculated scheme to defraud their donor base of $3 million and lied to them and used an illicit banking structure system to create shell companies to hide their money and who it was being sent to, specifically for the reason to sow discord and hate into our society. This is the ultimate definition of hypocrisy. And if you look at the indictment produced by the Department of Justice and the FBI, you will see that these banking institutions tie directly the funding mechanisms in which the Southern Poverty Law Center used to fund at least eight hate groups they supposedly wanted to take out, but they were paying the very villains of our society they supposedly wanted to protect us from.
That's the FBI Director Kash Patel on the topic of the Southern Poverty Law Center being the firefighter and the arsonist. Can you imagine? Let's get to our guest. Excited to talk to Hans von Spakovsky, Advancing American Freedom Senior Legal Fellow, former FEC Commissioner, and former DOJ lawyer about the Southern Poverty Law Center. Hans, when I hear Southern Poverty Law Center, I just on the surface think these should be some pretty good guys.
Yeah, and they're not. They've been a very biased partisan organization for a long time. You know, they started off as actually a good organization to go after, for example, the Ku Klux Klan. But that totally changed, frankly, more than two decades ago. And, you know, according to them, if, for example, you believe that our immigration laws should be enforced and the people who are here illegally should be removed, you know that makes you a hate monger according to their standards. And look, this is a very serious indictment. Almost a dozen charges include wire fraud, money laundering, false statements to a federally insured bank. And you know, the whole idea here was that they transferred, we're not talking about a little bit of money, Kenny, $3 million that they raised from their donors, telling their donors, oh, we're doing this to stop these kind of violent extremist hate groups. And then they funneled that $3 million to those organizations, to the leaders and organizers of those organizations, everything from the Ku Klux Klan to Aryan Nations. And they set up, if you can believe it, fictitious bank accounts. That's where the money would go from the donors. Then they would launder it through them. That's why they've been charged with money laundering, lying to federally insured banks. And, you know, the one thing I haven't really heard anybody say is that, you know, the Justice Department is seeking, they're seeking civil forfeiture. That means that they, if they win this case, The organization is going to have to pay that $3 million back. They're going to collect it. And that's going to financially really hurt this organization, which I hope it does.
Yeah, I mean, the consequence of the illegality, the money laundering, the deceit that took place with how they're taking the monies in and the efforts, the lengths they went to try to cover that money up before it went to Aryan groups and KKK affiliations. You know, I'm really also thinking a lot about the other consequences that have stemmed from their actions. There's a Fox News post written here by Charles Kreitz. It says SPLC faces blowback from hate map targets after DOJ fraud indictment. Hans, I think it's really important to include in this conversation here the way that the Southern Poverty Law Center targeted Turning Point USA as a hate group, and Charlie Kirk lost his life because of a nutcase who decided that they were going to do something for the world and take that man out by assassinating him. I think the Southern Poverty Law Center's responsibility here might be just bigger than the dollars and cents of it.
Oh, no, there's no question of that. There have been not just Charlie Kirk, but there have been other reported incidents of people using the false information that they provided about other nonprofit organizations to then engage in violence against those organizations and the individuals who work there. No, they have a lot of responsibility for a lot of things, including, by the way, apparently part of the indictment was that they helped pay for and organize the Charlottesville protests that also ended up in violence. And look, I got to tell you, I think actually they had a pure profit motive from this. Why? Because how have they raised so much money over the years by convincing donors that there are growing hate, you know, all these hate groups, that that's growing in America, and therefore they need somebody to help stop it. Well, the actual truth of this is it's been on the decline. You know, racial hatred, things like that, that has been actually was going down for a long time. And when that happens, they can't raise money. So what do? They secretly finance.
Yeah.
Those kind of groups so that they can then say, oh, see what we told you? You need to give us money.
Speaking with Hans von Spakovsky, what do we know the details about? You know, they sent checks, millions of dollars to these entities that they were supposed to be fighting against. What do we know what the outcomes were? You know, the money, what it was specifically requesting, what they were paying them to do or what they were paying them for?
Well, they are claiming that these were confidential informants, but according to the Justice Department, and according to, look, this isn't just the Justice Department, this is according to the grand jury indictment. This money wasn't just going to people who were somehow telling them what these organizations are doing. These were going to the leaders and organizers of these organizations. So, in essence, they were funding them to engage in violence and potential violations of state and federal laws in the kind of activities they were involved in. You don't pay $3 million to informants, particularly because what did they do with that information? Well, they've been trying to compare themselves to, oh, the FBI does that.
Yeah.
When the FBI pays informants, they do it to get information that they then use to criminally prosecute. And that is not what this organization did.
Do you see? I mean, these are criminal charges. This is an indictment from a grand jury on criminal charges. Is there a flood of civil cases that are going to be coming Southern Poverty Law Center's way?
Oh, I would think so. If I was a donor who had given a lot of money to them, I would be filing a civil lawsuit accusing them of fraud and wanting to get my money back.
Hans, this is Ryan. I see a lot of Democrats coming out in support of Southern Poverty Law Center and saying, well, they were actually trying to get information. They were trying to infiltrate these hate groups, and that's why they were paying informants. Is there any way, like, have they shown that they actually got any information from these people? Because I haven't seen that at all.
No, they haven't. That's what I was just talking about. They didn't do anything with any information that they got from them. Like I said, this is not the FBI. This is not the FBI then criminally prosecuting. They simply used the violence that they were helping to finance to raise more money for their own organization.
Yeah, it wasn't. It's not investigative journalism by any stretch of the imagination. We're speaking with Hans von Spakovsky.
Among the hottest topics in national news right now, beyond bailing out Spirit Airlines and the SPLC being both the firefighter and the arsonist, is this one, redistricting in Virginia. Here's the Mark Cox Show.
We've got Ken Cuccinelli on the line with us, former acting Deputy Secretary of Homeland Security, now working with the Election Transparency Initiative. And good to have you back on, sir. How are you?
I'm doing well. I hope you are.
Yeah, I'm doing well, too. You of course, heard Spanberger say that when she was running for office.
Oh, gosh.
Then she gets in office and goes the opposite direction, huh?
Well, look, I wasn't surprised. I was one of the people jumping up and down, waving my arms, screaming, not a moderate. But, you know, Virginia found out fast.
Yeah.
She wasted no time. So, and not only did she support and push this gerrymander after she got elected, I mean, she was out advertising it just like Barack Obama was. And, but the difference is Barack Obama didn't condemn it before he got elected.
Right. Right. Yeah, it's a good point. You know, before on the eve of that election last week or earlier this week, I read your ex post on all of the reasons why this violated, all the ways this violated the Virginia Constitution.
Yeah, it was pretty brazen.
Yeah, and you were right.
Yeah, well, I usually am, but...
I love it.
What were those ways?
So there's just looking at the state constitution, there are four constitutional problems with what they've done here. One is the map itself. It's such a radical gerrymander, and we have an anti-gerrymander provision. If this map doesn't violate it, no map violates it. But that, in fact, is the weakest of the four arguments. The other three relate to the process by which the referendum was put on the ballot itself. And like a lot of states, Virginia's General Assembly, under our Constitution, has to pass a proposed amendment twice, once before and once after a state election. Well, the last time the Democrats had control, back in around 2020, meaning governor and both houses, they gave us this wonderful 45-day election. Nobody needs a 45-day election, but we have it. That's the polls open for 2025. We also, by the way, vote in odd years for our state elections. So the voting started for Abigail Spanberger's race on September 19th last year, 45 days before Election Day. Well, the General Assembly didn't pass this proposed amendment until Halloween. And they want to treat that election as the intervening election required by the Constitution, even though over a million people had already voted when they passed the thing for the first time. And so that's constitutional problem one. At the same time, they were in what they called a special session, which was actually called by Governor Youngkin a year and a half earlier to deal with the budget. Well, again, unlike Congress, when states call a special session, it can only address the subject for which it's called, the budget.
Right.
So they violated two different constitutional provisions in addressing a constitutional amendment without, they could have gotten there, but they needed a two-thirds vote of the General Assembly. Of course, they weren't going to get that with the Republicans, so they just skipped that part, as they said in Princess Bride at the wedding.
Yeah. Well, we just sort of skipped that part.
And so those two constitutional arguments are in front of the Virginia Supreme Court already, because they had been filed on in January and February. A lot of people were concerned when the Virginia Supreme Court didn't take the case up in February and they held it. But that was consistent with over 100 years of legal precedent in Virginia. The vote in a referendum is part of the legislative process under Virginia law. So it's analogous to a governor signing or vetoing a bill. Well, Spanberger's got the assault weapons ban now on her desk. I would not presume to sue now before she either signed or vetoed it. But if she signs it, I'm going to sue, because the legislative process will be over and the courts can address it at that point. So they weren't ducking. They were actually, shock of shocks, how unused to this are we, acting consistent with longstanding law. So, but now they're moving really fast. Briefs were filed yesterday in the Virginia Supreme Court. Oral argument is Monday morning. So tune in next week, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't think they'll decide the same week, but they realize, look, there's an election on. We do have these stupid 45-day elections. And even though the General Assembly, with Spanberger's cooperation, moved our primaries back from June to August to buy some time, that still has voting starting in early July. And it's already late April. So not only do you need time to campaign, you've got to qualify candidates and so forth. So the court knows they have to go fast. I think they will probably decide and overrule this referendum based on one of the two constitutional challenges that are already in front of it, probably by mid-May. So that brings me to the fourth one, which was ruled on. You probably saw news this week that in Southwest Virginia, the Tazewell Circuit Court threw out the referendum and has enjoined the counting of the votes, the certification of the election. And that was based on the second passage. Remember, I said it has to pass once before an election and once after. Well, what they call second passage was January 16th of this year, when the new General Assembly came in, still Democrat. And the requirement there is that after second passage, 90 days have to go by before submitting it to the voters. Well, with our 45-day election, that was March 6th.
Sure.
Less than 2 months after second passage. So, yeah. You know, I know a lot of people go to law school to avoid math, but this is a little ridiculous. You know,
Kim and I went to journalism school to avoid math. Yeah. I get it. Yeah. I did. Ken Cuccinelli, listen, we appreciate your efforts there with the Transparency Initiative, the Election Transparency Initiative. We'll have you on again soon. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Red Meat, a collection of conservative audio from Odyssey's talk stations across the country. This is the place where we're not afraid to dig in. Listen wherever you get podcasts and smash that subscribe button.